Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Mac, and you are listening to Mac Musings. So if you bear with me while I dial my number, because I have to do it this way so that it will work. That's what Blog Talk Radio wants. Dial in the right number. Sorry about this. Bear with me, please. And his name is Jason Buterin, and hopefully it will go smoothly. So the number is dialing, and hopefully we'll be talking in a couple of minutes.
Hello.
Hello, Jason. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Hello, Mac.
Oh,
pleasure to meet
you. Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you, too. I always make sure people can hear me because with all the trouble that I've had with Blog Talk Radio, sometimes it takes a long time before I can even get on the air. So I'm so happy to have you on my show. I'm sorry.
I thank you and I appreciate your time. It's an honor to be here in my basement.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. And just so you're aware and the people listening are aware, there is an overlap. That's the bad sound of Blog Talk Radio. So bear with us, please, listeners, if we have any. So you started professionally in like 2006 on something called the Tontine. Is that right?
Professionally would be an egregious use of air quotes around that word, but I got my filmmaking start. Yes, well, let's go with that in 2006 with the Tontine, and then I also I got started with a project, a thing called the 48-hour film project, which is an international competition, and that was sort of my first foray into filmmaking. With the Tontine, I was an actor in front of the camera, and then I wanted to jump behind the camera because I wanted to be a screenplay writer.
Ah. So that was a good jumping for you, wasn't it?
It was. And I still, even to this day, I mean, I'm very lucky in that I get to participate in multiple projects on both sides of the camera. I love acting. It's one of my favorite things to do. Unfortunately, I don't possess the acumen or the talent to be able to act and direct at the same time. I don't have those things like that Kevin Smith does that amazes me, directors that can do that. So I don't really act in anything that I write or direct. I give myself, you know, wonderful little Silent Bob cameos in my stuff, but I can't direct and be in front of the camera at the same time. So hopefully, maybe someday I'll be able to do both, you know, two things at the same time. But the Tontine was a lot of fun because that was my first experience on a film set ever, and I got to see good things that happened and bad things that happened and what worked and what didn't work, and it opened my eyes up because before that point, and having never been on a film set, you literally have no idea the hours and hours and hours and days that it takes even to make a short film, and then just to be able to see that and see all the waiting and all the time and everything, it was an eye-opening experience for sure.
Just tell a little bit of what it's about.
The Tontine?
Yeah.
It was based in that particular story, I believe, and I hope I'm getting all this right, Clive Barker had a Hellraiser magazine, sort of a companion piece, you know, somewhat to what Heavy Metal magazine was doing in its heyday. And the Tontine was one of the stories that I believe had appeared in Hellraiser magazine that was illustrated by a local artist out of Chapel Hill by the name of Scott Hampton, who's done some absolutely brilliant comic book work art as well as writing. I think he had illustrated the version of that story in Hellraiser magazine, had a rapport, a relationship with Clive, and then I guess had optioned the rights to be able to make a short film version out of that. And Scott, I worked at a comic book store called Parts Unknown, which is in Greensboro, North Carolina, an amazing comic book shop. But Scott came in there all the time, and he knew the owner and stuff like that. So I honestly don't remember how I got involved into it. I think it was because of knowing Scott. And they needed actors. And at the time I looked like Rob Zombie and Chris Robinson's little brother. So I got thrown in it. I got thrown into it, but I did. I mean, it was like, I was always the bastard love child of like Jesus and Chris Robinson and Rob Zombie, depending on where I went. And it was a good time, but I think because of that, I guess my unusual appearance at the time, which always seems to follow me no matter wherever I go, I was lucky enough to be able to get put into that, and then met a couple other people who, once I got involved with the 48 Hour, I wanted to be able to work with those people. And I mean, it's just the entire filmmaking thing snowballed beyond my wildest dreams and or expectations. I had no idea that that would put me on the path and that would lead me to where I am now. I guess nobody ever does. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's actually what all actors, even, you know, famous people, they say the same thing, because you never know. You start out with something that you're only in it for like 20 seconds, and then you end up being a movie star. So it can happen.
Exactly. So, you never know who's going
to be there. Yes, that's exactly right. So in 07, you did something called The Devil's Tramping Ground. Now on that, you were the writer, executive producer, and actor. So what was that like?
Yes, it was a beautiful cluster in just learning about film vivaciously. Devil's Tramping Ground, we did the 48 Hour in 2006, and that was fun, but I wanted to do something else. And we were lucky enough to be able to get an honorable mention for best writing, which let the fire under my butt. I was just like, I'm an award-winning screenwriter now. And I wasn't, but I thought that I was. So I wanted to do something different. And I've been a writer my entire life. I mean, I've written novels. I was a syndicated columnist. Like, I've had a lifelong love affair with words. But I wanted to do something different. I didn't just want to do 48 hour stuff. So I wanted to be able to find, and having been in North Carolina for about 6.5-7 years at that point, I wanted to find something that was just very specific to North Carolina. I wanted to find a ghost story that you couldn't find anywhere else. And this, you know, back in 2006, 2007 was still the antiquated era of the internet, where
right.
You know, it wasn't the social networking mass media orgy extravaganza of nonsense that it is now. So you actually still had to research stuff. You couldn't just type in the Google box and get everything done for you. But I found a couple of different stories, and one was about the Devil's Tramping Ground, and the other was about like the ghost of a girl under an overpass on a highway, which I grew up in the backwoods of the back roads of Missouri. I've heard that story 17 times, you know, but I had never heard anything like the Devil's Tramping Ground, which was, excuse me, it's supposed to be a 40-foot circle outside of Siler City, North Carolina. 40-foot circle in diameter where nothing will ever grow. No plants, no nothing. It's just a 40-foot barren circle. And then, you know, there are all these rumors, all these legends, all these urban myths and stuff like that about if you camp out inside the circle, you'll wake up and your stuff will be scattered in every direction. It was just, you know, everything that I read, these very, very incipient, almost like journal-like accounts of all the evil that people experienced out there, built up this very sinister impression in my head, and I couldn't wait to see this place. It had to be the ultimate incarnation of just fucking evil and just everything dark and sinister that I wanted to find in a camping spot. So we went out there, had a couple of people, and we stopped off at the gas station, which I think was also City Hall and the fire department and the post office. Because we couldn't, there were no signs. I mean, this was before GPS, back in the day, kids, before GPS. So we stopped off at the gas station. Bartles was seated in a rocking chair on one side of the door. James was on the other side. We're like, they looked at us. They automatically knew. They're like, you're looking for the Devil's Tramping Ground. Yeah. It was like, yes. So they pointed us, like, go back by the fence that used to be there, but isn't there anymore. So we're like, oh. So with those very, very wonderfully local directions, we still managed to find it. We found the place where we were supposed to stop the car. So we got out of the car, we hike, and we find a little 4-foot burn pit with a bunch of scattered Schlitz boxes and paraphernalia and everything else. And I was like, this cannot possibly be it. So we trekked further, like I made people walk 2 hours into the woods in the summertime. And we didn't get, like, we ended up on some guy's cow farm. So, like, the little 4-foot burn pit that we walked by was apparently the devil's tramping ground. So it was one of the most anticlimactic experiences I'd ever had. But I was still obsessed by the story, and I was able to do a little bit more research, and actually had to go to a library and look stuff up in books, which is fun. But found out there were all these different origin myths and stuff like that about the devil's tramping ground. I mean, I actually went back to the mid-1700s, and they had – originally, the one that I obsessed about the most was that the reason there was a 40-foot circle is because that was where the devil would walk around in a circle at night and plot out all the machinations of the world's evils, all his dastardly plans. He would just walk in a circle and make plans, and those plans would carry out. But I loved that idea. I mean, I've also always just loved the Faustian myth. And at the time I was in a rock and roll band. So I just sort of wanted to be able to combine all three and making a rock and roll Faustian myth about a band that makes a deal with the devil. That's what, some of the best stories throughout history are about. So that's what we tried to do with it. We had no idea what we were doing. We were whiskey wet behind the ears, independent film crew. We had two directors. I had no idea what the screenplay formatting was. I was just writing out like massive prose paragraphs of sheets. I'm like, I'm a screenwriter. And it was a nightmare. But still, we managed to pull something off that was, it took way too long. Yeah. And again, we had no idea what we were doing, but we still pulled off something that I think is formidable. Is it a good movie? No, absolutely not. But no one's first five movies ever are. Unless you're Robert Rodriguez and you get extremely lucky or something like that. But I mean, we were still able to pull something off, but it's a story that I've actually been thinking about a lot lately, because everything we've been doing with our film and the film that we hopefully getting ready to release soon and building up to bigger and better things. The Devil's Tramping Ground is a story I would very much like to revisit. Because it's an absolutely amazing piece of North Carolina specific folklore that you won't find anywhere else. It's not like, the ghost of the girl under the overpass who got hit by a car on prom or one of those other, just something that you find, these locally repeating, endemic, supernatural stories and stuff like that. Like, I never heard about the Devil's Tramping Ground before, and there's an amazing book I've got. Actually, I think it's called The Devil's Tramping Ground. It was compiled off of a series of 1940s and 1950s radio shows about North Carolina spook stories, basically. And then there's some interesting ideas in that. But it's on the agenda to make a feature-length Devil's Tramping Ground film and to make it absolutely amazing and to make it something that North Carolina and North Carolina film can be proud of. So it's on the agenda. But it was an interesting experience. I wasn't supposed to be in the cast. I just wanted to write it. And because I put the band in it, the guy who was going to play the drummer originally and the actor quit. And I was the only other person I knew who knew how to play drums. Cause honestly, one of my biggest fucking pet peeves in movies is fake bands. I hate fake bands.
Me too.
I can't stand fake. It just drives me batshit crazy. And some of that comes down to the editing and stuff like that. Like you can edit it better to where, somebody, and for me, especially being a drummer, it's like you see the person on screen, put the stick down, and then 3 seconds later, pow! No, time it right. If you don't know how to play the song, fake it. But it's been one of my biggest pet peeves ever since I got involved. So I threw myself into that role and then very quickly learned my lesson. but it was an amazing learning experience because we learned a lot of stuff of what never to do ever again.
Well, that's actually what first and second and even third movies are sometimes, just to learn.
Oh yeah. What's that? I had no idea, knew nothing about screenwriting, formatting, all this. All the writing I had done before was just a completely epistolary medium. I mean, there was never that visual component behind it. So then, and I've been told I have a very visual way of writing. So I've always put way too much direction into my writing, which is actually how I got involved into becoming a writer and director instead of just a writer. And The Devil's Tramping Ground had a lot to do with that.
Well, I think it could definitely use a second telling. I mean, or maybe even a continuation. Maybe start working on that next.
Yeah, I mean, not a second telling. I mean, I want to, what we did before, you know, I almost think of that more as like a proof of concept. We had, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, but we did it and we pulled it off. But knowing what we know now, and just with the relationship of cast and crew and everyone else that we've built up, we could truly, you know, we did something cool before. We can make something truly amazing now, and that's really what I want to be able to kind of focus on. So, I mean, I love ghost stories. I love being scared. I don't, you know, I mean, I love horror. It's always my first love, but, I sort of find myself straying from a lot of the modern horror tropes, especially with filmmaking, because you don't need to show everything. You don't need to gross them out. You don't need to throw everything at them. You can still scare right. the shit out of people, but you don't have to show it. You don't have to fill in every single blank. So it's something I would love to be able to do with The Devil's Tramping Ground, is just tell an amazing cinematic ghost story that, you know, that has, you know, the proper effects, the natural balance of practical over digital. But I mean, there's something truly amazing that can be made out of that story. So that's hopefully on our agenda after much, much work and many more years. Maybe we'll get lucky. I don't know.
Well, I hope you do work on it, because it sounds like it would be an interesting thing. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to move on, if it's okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So for the listeners, I just wanted to point out for the listeners that on IMDb, you have 94 credits in 20 different categories. So that's one reason why, obviously, we can't go through every single movie, and I just picked out a few to go over, and when I mention each one, I'll say why I picked it. The first one that I picked was from 2011, called A Killer Christmas Carol, and I think that kind of speaks for itself, because, you know, Christmas Carol, so talk about that a little bit.
Okay, that was, yeah. Wow, 2011. That's almost 10 years ago. It's kind of what's blowing my mind. and then I start to really feel old, and then that just makes everything much, much worse. A Killer Christmas Carol was really cool, because that was directed by my, you know, good friend, Mr. Louis Biko, written and directed. Louis, it's pronounced Louis. It's spelled Louis. I call him Lando. I tend to give everyone nicknames that seem to stick. But it was really cool, because we sort of had the idea going around about maybe doing an anthology around, you know, a horror anthology around holidays, and, you know, kind of making like the creep show version of The Great Pumpkin, and picking like Arbor Day and having the trees kill people. I mean, just kind of trying to flip the script a little bit on some of the holidays. Have Flag Day and people get smothered by flags. Like, there was a whole lot, but we talked about Christmas, and then there's the whole Jesus versus Santa thing. I was like, we should do something about Krampus. We had a brilliant local friend, Mr. Ian McDowell, who always read a lot of Krampus stuff in and around Christmas time. And then Lando just sort of latched onto that idea and started taking it on and wrote a very dramatic, a dramatic horror story around it. And we ended up, that was one of our first experiences working with Mr. Joe Harp, who is the effects director out of Kersey Valley Spooky Woods in North Carolina. And that man is just absolutely brilliant. But working with him in terms of trying to create our version of Krampus, and we ended up casting in the role of Krampus at the time. I believe he was a highway patrol officer down in Charlotte by the name of Darren Conrad, 6'5" or 4". I don't know, just, it's like a fucking fleshy brick wall, like just a very large, imposing specimen of a character. But Darren, being born and raised in and around the South, had a very Southern accent, and Krampus, being Germanic in origin, you know, we had a couple of speaking roles, or a couple of lines for him, and it was just like it ended up being very charming and very endearing. It didn't work. It didn't film the way we thought it would, but it still kind of worked itself out. So it was just, That was, you know, again, it was supposed to be a much larger project that got boiled down into a short film. I was assistant director on it, but I had, at that time, I had no idea what an assistant director was supposed to do. So I kind of just, we've all worn entirely way too many hats on film sets anyway, especially in any film set, because you don't generally have the luxury to be able to pay people, or let alone pay people right. what they're worth for their time. So you just have to do whatever isn't being done. So, I mean, it was really, really cool, because it was a practical makeup effects intensive film. And it was kind of a cool story. Cause, I mean, there's a role of a fellow in there who plays Santa Claus, who's, you know, who plays St. Nicholas. So you kind of have, I mean, effectively it's a Santa Claus versus Krampus story, but framed within a much more a personable, dramatic storyline, I guess. But it was cool. And I mean, the poster, you know, the artwork, everything else like that, like it was a good time. One of the locations we got to shoot at, I had the people who were involved in the Mad Ones crew at the time had a barn with a few acres of property and a huge house, but the barn, the second floor of the barn, was an actual a wood lined, wood trimmed paneled bar. And that was shortly after North Carolina, you know, banned smoking in bars and stuff like that. So it was like, we used the hell out of that location, because if we wanted to have something time stamped or something dated, if you were in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s or even the early aughts, you could smoke in bars, but you can't. And so it was a wonderful location to be able to circumvent some of the rules and stuff like that. So we used that a lot for Christmas Carol too, but that was fun. And I mean, me personally, I love to absolutely abuse alliteration as much as I can. So Killer Christmas Carol, just like, it's a brilliant title. So it was a really fun short film to be a part of. I still think we should take that horror holiday anthology idea and make it something real.
Yeah, it sounds real interesting to me. I like stuff like that. So the next one I pick.
I'll say that. I mean, just, you know, I mean, there's so many holidays out there that people have no idea. I mean, you know, everyone loves to celebrate Cinco de Mayo. They don't. Most people have no idea about the less than pleasing origins of the holiday. You know, St. Patrick's Day. Well, so many holidays break down to pagans versus Christians, pagans versus religion, you know. I mean, there's so many different little spins and stuff like that you could put on it. I would love to do an Arbor Day movie. There was a fantastic short film that came out several years ago called Treevenge, which is kind of like the Christmas tree buying short film, but told from the killer tree's perspective. And it's absolutely just bloody brilliant. But I would love to do like an Arbor Day film about that, like people that plant all these trees, and then like the next year the trees come back to kill all the people. I mean, there's so much out there that can be done that doesn't have to be, I mean, it doesn't have to be a reboot or a re-franchise or a remake or a reimagining or a re-whatever. There's so many brilliant ideas that are out there, and I think that's honestly one of the things I love so much about the world of independent film and the lens of short film making, is because you're not bound by a lot of these rules. There's not that stagnant pool of ideas that you have to keep fishing from. You can do whatever you want. You just have to make it good. You have to make it watchable and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's one of the things I always love about independent films. I mean, there's no way I could have gotten to where I am now without having gone through all those trials and tribulations and monumental and everything else.
Well, this next one I picked, it's called Bombshell Bloodbath, and the reason that I picked it was because of the character. It said on IMDb that you played the quote asshole bar guy unquote.
Yep, asshole bar guy will forever be one of my favorite film credits. Bombshell Bloodbath. Well, aside, again, from having a wonderfully alliterative name, that was another one of those projects that was written, directed by the very, very talented Mr. Brett Mullen, who I've been able to work with a lot in multiple capacities. He served as the DP and cinematographer on one of my short films called Don't Let the Light In. And Brett is one of those people. I would love to hate him, but I can't, because he's too nice. But, you know, he picks up the camera, and whatever he's pointing it at, it's a brilliant fucking picture, or it's a great shot. He's got one of those, just an inherent, innate skill behind the camera that it's just, he can frame, he can compose. It's amazing. But Bombshell Bloodbath, it was originally another project. It was supposed to start off as an anthology, and then due to just the sheer amount of work and commitment and effort from people and stuff like that, the anthology evolved and sort of boiled down into one of the stories from that anthology, which, you know, the short became a feature, so to speak. And Brett, again, you know, worked with Joe Harp and his crew out of Curacy Valley and just an amazing amount of people. But he made, because Brett is very, very much enamored by Fulci and Argento, you know, is very, very much a student of the giallo genre. So, I mean, that's what he's always wanted to be able to do, you know, to be able to make, you know, not make a Fulci zombie story, but to tell his zombie story in a Fulci kind of way. And I think that's what he did with Bombshell Bloodbath, which was amazing. My day on set, I had one day on set, and I actually got to play, bar asshole. It should have been, like, bar asshole number one, really, because, I put on an exquisite performance. I channeled years of being bullied and picked on and being the freak misfit in a bar, because I was always in the band anyway. But it was cool, because one of the lead characters in Bombshell Bloodbath, portrayed by the always amazing Alex Elliott, and she's just absolutely amazing. But she's in the bar and just kind of doing it and just, you know, trying to enjoy a drink, just trying to have a drink at the bar. And me being bar asshole number one, see the pretty lady at the bar and naturally assume that she's there for me. So I go up with my charming, colloquial, cunning, words of woo. They do not work at all. And then she promptly takes the pool stick that I was holding on to, breaks it, and shoves part of it somewhere. I will let your listeners fill in their own details on. So I met a very grisly end at what should have been a friendly game of billiards. But it was just it was amazing. And it was a lot of fun. It, you know, again, the project evolved 6 ways from Sunday from what it was supposed to be, but it was cool. And I mean, I got to be bar asshole and I got to play the worst game of billiards ever. So it was fun. It was a lot of fun. It's masochistic, I guess. I'm like, I love getting a pool stick shoved up my poop, but it's like, yeah, I mean, it was a good time. You know, I got to take off work. So it could have been worse. I wasn't at the office.
Well, from what I hear from my relatives and just from friends that are in the business, they always like playing the assholes better than they like playing the goody two shoes.
Oh, it's great. Well, I mean, you get to, and again, I mean, I've always lived on the island of misfit toys. I never fit in anywhere, middle school, high school, at any point in time. And a lot of that's probably intentional. But being always having been on the other side of the fence, like I was able to channel all the assholes I'd met in bars, all the people like you just want to smack, all the people I wanted to do the same thing to, you know, with the pool stick, what Alex did to me. So it was super cool. But again, just to have been a part of that project and to see how it evolved from when it was going to be an anthology. And then, cause Brett really took the helm and he's just like, he wouldn't let it die. And to be able to see him take that initiative and to bring it instead of from a short film into a feature film, that ended up, like, I think it's on, like, Teatro International is a distributor of that. And I believe it got a different name. Bombshell Bloodbath, it became something else. I think it got named something else when it came out. But, I mean, it was just, it's an amazing film. The poster, the artwork, everything about that movie is just fucking beautiful. Which, again, is something like, I would really like to hate Brett Mullen, but I can't because he's just too damn nice and too damn talented. Very frustrating sometimes.
Well, another one that I wanted to ask you about, because now I'm not a Doctor Who fan at all. I've tried to watch.
I won't
Doctor
hold that
Who.
Against you.
I can't stand it. But I saw, for the Doctor fans listening, that you did an episode of a TV series, and it's called Doctor Who, The Ginger Chronicles. So if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Oh, God, that was so much fun. And that was the brainchild largely of Lily Nelson and Rebecca Larkin, who are two amazingly talented writers, producers, actresses that I've worked with on multiple occasions. But And it was something, especially given not being the Doctor Who fan. And again, I won't hold that against you, but we will talk about that later. it was something kind of brilliant because one of the things I love about Doctor Who, aside from, again, I mean, I grew up in the backwoods of the back roads of Missouri, so we got three TV stations that came in, one of which was PBS. If I wanted to watch anything on a Sunday night, it was PBS. So I grew up watching a lot of like weird, just 70s and 80s British TV because that was my only option. So, I mean, and then, yeah, it kind of was like the Doctor, you know, Doctor Who, what? And then I saw the Daleks, and they looked like fucking salt and pepper shakers with plungers sticking out of them. But people were terrified of them. I'm like, I don't get it, but I can't stop watching. And I would tune in the next week and the week after that. And I got sucked in a wonderful, non-prurient kind of way. However, back to the Ginger Chronicles. One of the things I love so much about that, you know, with Doctor Who, the Doctor is always changing. You have these multiple incarnations of the Doctor, which allows different actors to be able to portray the same character. But, you know, the character itself goes through these physical changes so that it's not just like, you know, a different person playing the same character in a different episode. And people are like, oh, this is fine. Nothing's changed. That's one of the beautiful things about that is that you have that extrinsic sort of chameleon-like evolution throughout the character. That's why... I mean, that show came out, Jesus, hot thing, Christ. I think it started the day that JFK was assassinated, November 22nd, 63. That's why the show is still on. The most current incarnation of the Doctor, which I believe it's the 13th or the 12th, and it depends on which timeline you adhere to, and that just gets a bunch of nerds frothing, and I want people to get along. I don't want to make nerds froth. So we're just going to call it Lucky Number 13. The most current incarnation of the Doctor is portrayed by Jodie Whittaker. So it's the very first time that the Doctor has been a female. Don't know why, because every other character on Doctor Who is just like, they'll sleep with whatever, and gender doesn't matter because it doesn't fucking matter anyway, because it matters who you are on the inside, but apparently people don't fucking understand that. However, we'll get into politics and everything else later. The thing I loved about the Ginger Chronicles was that they had made their incarnation of the Doctor a female, who was portrayed by Lily Nelson, who just is an amazing theatrical actress and a brilliant film actress as well. So I think having that theatrical background, she was able to bring that because the character of the Doctor is animated, is theatrical, no matter if it's on like shitty black and white 60s BBC cameras or the current, like, you know, 4K, 8K, Ultra HD, whatever they shoot in now. Like, it's always, it's like a real life cartoon character. And Lily Nelson has an amazing combination to be able to do that. So what her and Rebecca Larkin had concocted was to make their own incarnation of the Doctor to make it a female. And the Doctor always has, generally has companions to travel with him to times, which are Earthlings who get sucked into the various adventures and whatnot. So that's what they had kind of done. And they wanted to make it a web series. So they had done their first episode, introduced his character, introduced the companions and stuff like that. And it went, I think it was an interesting experience as far as what I've been able to discern, but they wanted to do a second episode. But what they wanted to start doing was kind of start doing mashups, to be able to combine different areas of fandom, to be able to, you know, to bring something different into Doctor Who. And the story that they came up with was taking the characters of the Gentleman from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the series. And if you don't know the characters of the Gentleman, well, the Buffy, all listeners should just stop what they're doing after this episode is over and just go watch the entire Buffy series because it's fucking amazing. but the monsters, these characters that were called the Gentleman, are some of the creepiest and scariest and most frightening villains ever on screen, and they never say a word. They're just, you know, they're dressed very nicely. You've got these demonic, you know, humanoid, demonic looking souls that are wearing like three-piece suits and they've got the ties, very prim and proper, but these smile, you know, they've got a smile on their face, six heads wide, and it's just unnerving and unholy. So what they had did with the Ginger Chronicles was they introduced the characters of the Gentleman in this world, this universe of Doctor Who that they had built. And I got to play one of the Gentlemen. So, and I've been a Buffy fan, well, forever, really. So to be able to be part of something that was Buffy and Doctor Who at the same time while playing one of the Gentlemen was just amazing. And it was hours and hours of makeup. And the beauty of shooting anything in North Carolina is if you don't shoot it for like 3 days in December, it's fucking hot. and sweaty and miserable and humid and gross and, you know, moisture pools in areas it should never collect in, but you still keep doing it. And it was an amazing story. And I mean, they were able to successfully and creatively combine Buffy and Doctor Who into an award-winning short film. So it was just, that was a super amount of fun. My brother, Michael Ray Williams, he was playing one of the companions of the Doctor at the time. So, you know, I mean, I got to be able to have scenes with him, and it was fun to be able, especially for a guy who has a hard time shutting the hell up sometimes, to be able to play a character who doesn't get to talk was nice. I just had to smile. Although it was really weird because for like 2 weeks after that, it hurt to smile because that's all the gentleman. I mean, again, these smiles take up their entire faces. Very ghoulish, very garish. So it's like it. I don't think I smiled for like a fortnight after that. But it was an amazing thing, and I mean, it did really well on the film festival circuit, and then they had they did another episode recently, last year, year before last, time blurs together, that I was lucky enough to direct, where they took the Elf on a Shelf, and merged that, you know, Elf on a Shelf, the whole Christmas hullabaloo, but within Doctor Who, there's a series of monsters called the Weeping Angels, so they're these statues, you know, concrete statues of angels. But when you look at them, they freeze. They're quantum locked. When you look at them, they stand still. When you blink or turn your face, that's when they attack and kill you. So they combined that monster with the Elf on a Shelf, and it was a really good story. So it's one of those just, you know, indie fan film nerdvana type of heartfelt homages. It was super fun to be a part of. I've never been a part of anything like it since.
Well, it sounds like something that would be something that I might want to watch. Even though I'm not a Doctor Who fan, every once in a while I watch an episode. So, but if it's okay, I want to move on to what, because I want to get at least one other one in before we talk about Kill Giggles. And I picked it because I am a Star Wars fan. So you did something called An Identity Thieves, a Star Wars fan film. So just like a couple of minutes.
Oh, God, that was so much fun. Written and directed by the absolutely fucking amazing Justin Reich. And the guy, he got to start, you know, he was a photographer. He started doing music videos, doing short films. Like, he's one of those like Brett Mullen. I am jealous of him, and I wish I could not like him. But I can't because he's one of the nicest souls I've ever met. He's insanely gifted, but the Star Wars fan film thing, he'd worked with a lot of short film people and stuff like that, or short film actors, been on different sets and stuff like that. But Star Wars world, Star Wars film, Lucasfilm, I guess at the time before they were owned by the House of Mouse, held an international fan film competition. It was worldwide, so. Justin hit a few of us up, and he's like, I've got an idea about doing this, and we sort of picked it up after, because that was shortly after episode 7 came out in my nerddom, The Force Awakens, that's what it was called. Shortly after The Force Awakens came out, he had just a brilliant idea about a story that picked up with a bunch of characters that were nowhere ever mentioned or seen in that film, but what they were doing while that was going on. And we had shot it out at a place called the Singletree Plowin' Inn, which was like an outdoor cabin camping resort thing, but it was hard to find. You had to work to be able to find it, but you're up just in the mountains in North Carolina. I mean, it looked amazing, but the places that were there looked like the planet in The Force Awakens. Beautifully lush forest scenes and stuff like that. Very, very cool. So he hit up a few of us, and we got to be a part of that. I got to play a character by the name of Snark Fufa, which was great because I got winded trying to pick up, you know, this lovely little actress who was playing Rey, who, I mean, had to weigh like 70 pounds, you know, soaking wet. I mean, just a waif of a person. And I still got winded picking her up, and that's when I realized how just absolutely out of shape I was at the time. But you know, we had Rey, we had Kylo Ren, we got the costumes down, but we were able to, you know, we didn't have to show the vehicles. We didn't have to show space battles. We, you know, the DP that Justin had at the time, who I believe his name was Mr. Jonathan Sunstein, was one of those people that picks up a camera, whatever they take a picture of, just looks amazing. So it had that cinematic view. And then again, the people that were both in front of and behind the camera really brought that together, but made the short film, you know, Identity Thieves, put it out there and stuff like that. And then a couple of weeks later, we found out that we made some sort of like international semi-final round. Well, I mean, and that was amazing enough. You know, a few weeks after that, what we did is we got boiled down to, we were in the top 25 of all the international submissions. So that short, Identity Thieves, was in the top 25 from everything around the world. And watching some of those films that just had amazing budgets or amazing effects people, and they had their own spaceships and massive battles and stuff like that, to be in the same group as them, you know, even honestly just to be in the same level of nerddom with them was amazing. But to be in that same tier was just something, you know, I mean, to me that helped to prove how amazing Justin is as a story writer. I mean, he's not coming at it from that complete fanboy nerd type of background, but he nailed it, and he nailed it insanely well. So, I mean, that was really cool. And also, I mean, because I got, honestly, the best part of that, because my wife brought my son out to set, and my son at that time was about between 3 and 4. You know, he had seen Force Awakens, but he comes out, she lets him out of the car, and then Kylo Ren's walking up right behind me, and he freaked out. Like, he got to hang out with Kylo Ren. I mean, it was just, as far as he's concerned, you know, he was in a Star Wars movie. He went back and told his friends at school that he's like, my daddy's in Star Wars movies. So every time I show up, they're like, you're a Star Wars guy. I'm like, sure, I'm a Star Wars guy. I may have embellished a little bit, but they were kids. But no, that was, yeah. And again, I've been incredibly far too lucky in my short time of just doing film that, yeah, it's, I've got to be able to do some amazing things. I'm not done yet, dang it.
Well, yeah, you want to keep doing it as long as you can. Well, it sounds like something I'd want to watch. Like I said, I'm a Star Wars fan, but I think you're done talking about that. So if you are, we can move on to something you're working on now called Kill Giggles. And you've got still quite a bit of time left. You've got just under 18 minutes. So talk all you like about Kill Giggles.
That's the thing we did. It's fine. Let's talk more about you. Why don't you like Doctor Who? That bothers me. We'll save 42 seconds to talk about Doctor Who, because there's a nice Douglas Adams homage. Kill Giggles.
Well,
holy hells and hot.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. No, I was just, getting ready to launch into my Kill Giggle spiel. So if there's something you'd like to get out of the way now, it's okay.
Oh, no, I didn't know if you were serious or not. I was just going to say, I'm not a big fan of Doctor Who. Simply, I wouldn't say I hate it. But every time I tune in and watch an episode, and I've seen every single person that's played Doctor Who, maybe not at the time that they were playing it, but you know, when it was older. But every time I turn the episode on, I'm like, I don't like this. And then that makes me not want to watch again for a while. So
I think
that's all.
That's understandable. I can respect that. All right. Kill Giggles. Well, first off, clowns are foul, fiendish, floppy-footed, unholy fuckers who I honestly don't think should exist on this planet. But that's why I'm not the great spiritual being in charge of things, because if I were, there wouldn't be clowns and people would use their turn signals and people would just stop bitching about politics and religion because it doesn't matter. However, back to my clown-killing rant. For the majority of my life, have hated clowns. I think up to about the age of 6, actually it was about to age 8, because at age 8 was when I got to see Poltergeist for the first time, and I saw the clown marionette, and that scene just completely unhinged my brain. That disturbed me on levels I did not know that I even had at that very young, tender age in my life. So, I mean, I was cool with clowns up until that, and then I saw that scene, and then I just, I hate, I don't want to see them. I don't like looking at them. I hate thinking about them. So what do I do 36 years later? I make a movie about clowns. Obviously, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but they've always been creepy to me. I've never thought they were funny. I've never thought they were cute. I hated them at the circus. I don't watch movies about them. You know, I've seen a couple of things, you know, It, the original, you know, the 90s made-for-TV incarnation, you know, the more recent remakes, reboots, refresh, whatever the fuck you want to call them. And those are cool, but I hate clowns. I hate them with the fiery passion of a thousand suns. And being a horror filmmaker, I had obviously seen time and time and time and time again where the serial killers, the monsters, the murderers, the spreaders of mayhem, they were always either clowns or dressing up like clowns. And what I started thinking about several years ago was, why has there never been a serial killer of clowns? Why is it always one who dresses up? Like, what about somebody who just fucking kills clowns? All of them die. And that was sort of the grindhouse genesis, if you will, of what came to be Kill Giggles. Cause I started looking at it. I'm like, you know, surely someone has had to have done this before. And the more research I did, I realized it surely was completely wrong because no one had ever done anything like that before. I couldn't find anything like it, which just absolutely amazed me. Again, in the era of remakes and reboots and refranchises where stuff that was made 5 years ago is getting remade because we can't think of an original idea, so we'll just redo this because some schmucks will pay money for it. No, that's not the way movies should work. So I realized we had to be on to something. So I sat down and I was going to make it a short film. And then I had about 3 composition books completely packed full, line by line by line, not a blanket, you know, no blank space on the page whatsoever, of clown death. Which I realized, and I hope will probably come in very handy as, you know, people's exhibit, you know, evidence A through C when I finally get committed, which I'm pretty sure my wife's got in motion already. I don't know why she wouldn't. But yeah, so I mean, what was going to be a short clearly just had to be a feature. And talking with a couple people, like, just make it a feature. And I had, you know, I had luck with shorts up until that point. But that was around 2013, 14, which is when we started taking our short filmmaking much more seriously and that's what sort of got us onto the film festival circuit. But with Kids, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to tell that story about a serial killer of clowns. So I thought, what if you have, and again, channeling a lot of my inner self, don't like him, hate him, want to kill him, but can't do it because otherwise I go to jail. So make a movie about it. At the same time, it seemed like very ill-advised psychotherapy, but just it was something I wanted to try. And I sat down and I started writing and writing and writing. The first draft of the screenplay, when I stopped, was at 300 pages, and I wasn't done yet. But every time I kept telling my DP how many pages it was, his eyes bulged out, and he peed a little, so I realized I had to start trimming it down. Otherwise, I was going to have that 18-hour-long Ken Burns-narrated documentary about clown killing, which could be cool, but ideally not the market we're going. So, I mean, it's just one of those things. I probably worked on it for 2 or 3 years before we ever even started filming promo stuff for the proof of concept. I thought about it and I had so much clown death. If we could have pulled it off that way, like it just would have been amazing, but it would have been egregious. I mean, just entirely way too much. But what I wanted to do with that, because one of the scenes that's always one of my favorite scenes from a movie ever is, well, one of my favorite movies ever is Psycho. But favorite scenes from that is the very last scene in the film, which, spoilers, kids, it's Anthony Perkins sitting in an interrogation room. But it's one of those that is so sublimely simple and powerful. And it's Anthony Perkins, and he's sitting there, and he's looking up. He's got the blanket. You know, the deputy brings a blanket on him, and you hear Mother Bates' voiceover. And they're like, all Anthony Perkins does is he just looks up. And, like, it's unnerving to an amazingly effective degree. And mm-hmm. I'd always, like, I mean, it's one of those things that just always pops in my head. And I wanted to be able to do that. I wanted to pay homage to that scene. So the very first scene I wrote for Kill Giggles was the very last scene. And that scene ended up evolving quite a bit from the way I originally wrote it. But I feel like we were able to sort of, I think once people see it, we were able to capture that. And again, I mean, it's not like we're not trying to recreate shot by shot. I mean, the people that will get it. And the people that don't get it won't know they're not getting anything they shouldn't get anyway. So, I mean, I wanted to be able to say thank you to Psycho. So I wrote that one first, and then I took some of the stuff from that and then wrote the very first scene and then just started filling in all these massive blanks in between. It took a very long time. And then, you know, there were certain death scenes I knew that I wanted and certain things I knew I wanted to do. But the big thing that I wanted to kind of circumvent was I wanted to make a horror movie that was more of a thriller than a horror. And again, I didn't, you know, and I mean, I don't get me wrong, listeners, faithful film fanatics and movie maniacs, I love blood and guts. And I mean, I love all this stuff. It's fantastic. But what I wanted to do was, I wanted to do what Hitchcock did, to tell a story that could completely unnerve people and not show anything. You know, the shower scene from Psycho is one of the most powerful cinematic scenes from the 20th century. But there's never anything that comes close. And granted, all the, you know, the strict ratings boards and everything else, the time of the 60s when that came out. But the thing that I always loved about that was that the lesson I always took from it was that you didn't have to show something to make people think something. And that's what I loved about that shower scene from Psycho, is because it's like, there's never one inch of nudity. There's nothing. You never see the knife anywhere close to Janet Leigh. There's not penetration of the knife. I mean, it's just like, you know, the stabbing motion, Janet Leigh falling down, the red Karo syrup swirling around the drain. That's it. But by the time people got done watching that scene, it was the most graphic, gory, visually disgusting thing that had ever been put to film. But they never showed anything. You know, they supplied 80% of it, 60% of it, and let the viewers fill in those blanks. And that was something that has always absolutely captivated me about filmmaking, is to be able to try and to do something like that. You know, to not have to, you know, and I love blood and guts and gore and making monsters and all that stuff, but I've always felt, and especially within the last, holy hell, dear gods, I mean, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, 30, 40, 15 years, fuck, the world is not the same by any stretch of the imagination that it was when Psycho came out. When The Exorcist came out, another film in The Exorcist, I love the stories behind that. You know, people seeing the movie for the first time in 1973 that are running up the aisle of the theater, like screaming, crying, shitting, and puking themselves all at the same time. I love that. You know, that one film had such a visceral reaction amazes me. Like, it blows my mind. That's one of the things, hearing the behind the scenes about that made me want to be a filmmaker before I ever even realized it myself. And I always tell, I mean, even now, like, I want somehow, ultimately, someday to be able to achieve that, to give people a visceral reaction without having to just completely cram it down their throats with effects and everything else. And I mean, just, you know, I've always wanted to be able to just scare the hell out of people without having to rely on filling in every single blank. And I think that's what The Exorcist has always done for me. That's what Psycho has always done for me. And I hope ultimately that's reflected in Kill Giggles. Cause there's a lot, there's no, I don't know if I should tell people, I guess we should, they're going to find out eventually. There's no nudity in Kill Giggles. And coming from a guy who invented a topless taco bar that he put in a short film trilogy about a hot pink Jesus, I'm still coming to issues. I'm coming to terms with that myself. But I mean, there's a lot of, I would say the contemporary modern horror tropes that we just made an intentional decision to sort of eschew for Kill Giggles. We have some amazing death scenes with some absolutely just bloody brilliant fucking effects, but it's not blood and guts and torture porn. You know, the scenes that we've got in there are powerful, but in the way that they advance the story further, it's not just a visual distraction in between bits of dialogue and and hearsay. So I don't know. Kill Giggles, I mean, aside from my son, I hope Kill Giggles will be my masterpiece until we make the next one. It's something, again, I've always wanted it to be more of a thriller than a horror. And then, honestly, one of the best things I have to talk about was Kill Giggles. I got to be able to work, you know, and having been on the film festival circuit for the last few years with a lot of our short films, which we were very lucky and had amazing response and acceptance for, I've been able to just build up an immense and impressive network of talented friends that I would not, you know, social network and face space and all that crap is fine. But one of the things that I love about film festivals, and holy fuck, I miss about film festivals. I wish there wasn't an apocalypse right now. Because it's film festival, it's not, if you're a filmmaker, if you're a film lover, it's one of the best places to ever be to watch movies. Because you watched something brilliant that you had no idea what the hell it was, but it had a cool sounding synopsis or it had a funny sounding title. And then you get to meet the people that made the movie. And I mean, it's an amazingly organic experience. It can never be replicated, not at conventions, not anywhere else, but at a film festival.
Right.
So take people, you know, that I had met at these film festivals. And I was lucky enough, you know, with my film experience, you know, one of the people that I met at a film festival, I met her at the Crimson Screen Horror Festival back in 2016, was Felissa Rose, who, you know, is obviously one of, you know, the main star of Sleepaway Camp. I mean, it's and she's the angel of death. It's Angela. And Sleepaway Camp to this day came out in 1983, still has one of the best fucking endings of a horror movie ever. No matter how graphic and gross everything else gets, like that ending of Sleepaway Camp is still jaw dropping. It's just like, it's crazy. You've seen it, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I have.
Okay, no, I just had to check. Otherwise, I was just going to have to end the interview early because I have to draw the line at no Sleepaway Camp. But we're cool. Okay.
Well, you wouldn't actually be ending it early because we've only got 3 minutes of air time left. So if you were almost done anyway, I think. So if you just want to wrap up Kill Giggles, then if you would tell people how they can get a hold of you, like say if they want to give you a job or something.
Okay. If they want to give me a job or money, that would be great. I have to finish my celebrity thing and I'll wrap it up. I've got a countdown on my clock going. So I met Felissa Rose at a film festival. Hit it off with her. She ended up voting for my movie. It was amazing, but we kept in touch. And she lent a voiceover to one of my short films, The Corner. And then I wrote a role for her in Kill Giggles. So I was like, I would love for you to come and be in Kill Giggles. She's like, okay. And she did it. She showed up. Mr. Vernon Wells, who, I mean, holy, it's Vernon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Vernon Wells. And she's like, well, you should put Vernon in the movie. I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. She's like, well, here, I'll text him and include you on it. And she did. And then 5 minutes later, I'm texting Vernon Wells. I was just like, okay. So we got him in there. I was on a feature film called Night of the Living Dead Genesis, which is being shot by Mr. Matt Cloud up in Luray, Virginia. And sort of a reboot, refranchise of that story idea. But he had Judith O'Day from the original Night of the Living Dead in it. And I got to be in a scene with her, which I'm like, I'm in a scene with Barbara. I'm like, holy shit. But it's still amazing. It still amazes me. But I kept in touch with her, had the idea for a role for her for Kill Giggles. And she's like, yeah, sure, I'd love to do it. So the thing, the lesson to be learned here, kids, adults, big kids, whoever's listening, believe in your fucking dreams. Don't stop believing, because I grew up in the backwoods of the backroads of Missouri. My two best friends were a video store and the library. And the video store where I would watch Sleepaway Camp and Night of the Living Dead and Mad Max and Weird Science and Interspace and all these movies, watching Vernon Wells and Felissa and Judith O'Day in movies religiously. And then 35 years later, they're in the film that I wrote and directed. I'm directing these people that I grew up watching, I grew up idolizing, who are looking
Very
at me
cool.
to tell them what to do. It's mind-blowing. It's absolutely crazy. So just believe in your dreams. Don't stop believing. It's what Steve Perry said, and it still holds true to this day. All right.
Very cool. But you've got, yeah, you've only got about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
All right. MadOnesFilms.com or KillGiggles.com. All the social media, you know, whatever, .com/MadOnesFilms. If you type in Kill Giggles, you're going to find us. If you type in Mad Ones Films, you're going to find us. And if you don't find us, let me know, and I will make sure that you find us. And if you're on a CB radio, holler at me. Our handle is clownkiller666. 10-4, good buddies.
Well, you could also tell them how to get you on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's, I didn't know how much time. I don't want to get played off. Yeah, I mean,
You know what? I'm sorry that we're on. You're not on the air now. The air cuts off even though we're still on the phone. Sorry about that.
No, I talk way too much, so I'm just happy to have had the time I did. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, well, at least they heard the part about kill giggles and all that. But, yeah, I was hoping that you'd have enough time to get the Facebook thing on there, but I'm sure they could figure that out by themselves anyway.
So, I honestly, at that point, if they haven't, we don't want those people if they